I heard Walter coughing. He never coughs. Not even in the morning. He's never smoked. Then I heard him choking. It got worse. I called out, Walter, are you all right, Walter?
Take your time, Mrs. March.
Then the choking stopped, and I thought he was all right. The telephone began ringing. Walter always picked up the phone on the first ring. It rang twice. It rang three times. I became very alarmed. I screamed, Walter! I got out of the tub as fast as I could, grabbed a towel, opened the door to the bedroom.
Which bedroom?
Ours, Walter's and mine. Walter was sort of on the bed, the foot of the bed, his knees sort of on the floor, as if he hadn't quite made it to the bed. He had come from the living room. The bedroom door was open. The scissors... I couldn't do a thing. He slipped sideways off the bed. Walter's a big man. I couldn't have caught him even if I'd been able to move. He rolled as he slipped. He fell on his back. The scissors... face so white. Captain Neal, a big blood bubble came up between his lips.
Mr. March, why don't you give your mother some of that?
Come on, Mother. No, I'll be all right. Just give me a moment.
Just a sip.
No.
We can postpone the rest of this if you like, Mrs. March.
I don't even remember going through the living room. I went through the open door to the corridor. I was just thinking, Helena, Jake. I knew they were in 7. We had met for drinks there the night before. There was the back of a man. There was a man in the corridor walking away, lighting a cigar as he walked. I didn't know who he was from behind. I ran toward him. Then I realized who he was. I ran to Helena's door and began banging on it with my fist. Helena finally opened the door. She was in her bathrobe. Jake wasn't there.
Mrs. March, did you go back into that suite?
My mother has not been back in that suite since. I was on Helena's bed. They left me alone for a long time. I could hear people talking loudly everywhere. Eleanor Earls came in. I asked her to find Junior.
Did you know, at that point, your husband was dead?
I don't know what I knew. I knew he'd landed on the scissors. I asked for someone to get Junior.
And Mr. March? I was in the coffee shop. I heard myself being paged in the lobby. Eleanor Earls was on a house phone. I came right up.
What did Ms. Earls say to you, Mr. March?
She said something had happened. My mother wanted me. She was in the Williams' suite, number 7.
She said, something has happened?
She said, something has happened. Come up right away. This is Eleanor Earls. Your mother's in Jake Williams' suite, number 7.
What did all that mean to you?
I couldn't imagine why Eleanor Earls was calling me about anything. In the elevator, I was thinking maybe there'd been an accident. I don't know what I was thinking.
Mrs. March, are you all right?
Yes.
Mrs. March, who was the man in the corridor?
Perlman, Oscar Perlman.
The humorist?
If you say so.
Why didn't you speak to him?
Oh.
I'm sorry. You said you ran toward him and then you didn't speak to him.
She said, Oscar Perlman has been very unkind to my husband. For years and years, very unfair.
Mother, realize what you're saying.
I'm sorry, Mrs. March, you'll have to explain that.
Well, years ago, Oscar used to work on one of the March family newspapers, and he thought he could write a humor column. He was always lazy. I've never thought him funny. Anyway, Walter encouraged him. He really developed the column for Oscar. Then, well, as soon as the column was established in one March newspaper, Oscar went off and sold it, and himself, to this syndicate. Very unfair. Walter was terribly hurt. Even last year, when Walter was nominated for the presidency of the Alliance, Oscar was saying bad things about him, or so we heard.
What sort of bad things?
Oh, foolish things. Like he tried to pass a bylaw saying only journalists could vote in the Alliance election, no private detectives.
Private detectives? What was that supposed to mean?
Oh, who knows? Oscar Perlman's a fool.
Mr. March, do you know what no private detectives means?
It doesn't mean anything. Walter March said. Oscar Perlman has a coterie of followers, mostly Washington reporters, poker players all, and he keeps them entertained with these sophomoric gags. I don't know. March Newspapers is pretty well known for its investigative reporting. Maybe he was trying to make some gag on that. I really don't know what it means. No one did. Utter hateful foolishness, Lydia March said. Mrs. March, your husband was a powerful man. He had been all his life. I know what you're about to ask, Captain Neal. I've been lying awake thinking about it myself. Walter was a powerful man. Sometimes powerful men make enemies. Not Walter. He was loved and respected. Why, look, he was elected president of the American Journalism Alliance. That's quite a tribute to a man. From his colleagues, people he had worked with all his life. Now that Walter was, well, about to retire. Speaking of that, I'm a little uncertain. Who takes over, who runs March Newspapers now that your husband... Why, Junior, of course. Junior's president of the company. Walter was chairman. I see. And Walter was retiring as soon as he had served out his term here at the Alliance. I see. No one in this world, Captain, had reason to murder my husband. Why, you can see for yourself. In this morning's newspapers. Even on the television. High Litwack's nice eulogy last night. The reporters are terribly upset by this. Every one of them, Captain Neal, loved my husband. Chapter 14. 11 a.m. God is in my typewriter, I know it. Addressed by Wharton Cruz. Conservatory. Bulldogging the major media, or bird-dogging. Weekly newspapers group discussion. Bobby Joe Hendricks Cocktail Lounge. Mr. Fletcher? Fletch squinted up from the poolside long chair at the young man in tennis whites, Hendricks Plantation written on his shirt. Yeah? You phoned for a court at 11 o'clock? I did. I am Fletcher? One of us is. We have you down for a tennis court at 11 o'clock. Thanks. Will you be needing equipment, sir? I guess so. Also a partner. Playing tennis alone takes too much running back and forth. You mean you want the pro? I guess not. Someone means to provide me with exercise. Stop at the pro shop a little before 11. We'll fix you up with the racket and balls, whatever you need. Have whites? Send them to my room, will you? Room 79? Sure. 30 waist? Guess so. Just ask the bellman to leave them inside the room. I have sneakers. Okay. Thanks, Fletch said. A chair scraped next to him. Fletch turned his head and squinted again. You're Fisher, aren't you? Stuart Poynton was sitting beside him in expensive leisure clothes, green shirt, maroon slacks, yellow loafers, as pleasant to look at as lettuce, tomato soup, and a lemon. Fletcher, Fletch said. That's right, Fletcher. Someone told me about you. Someone tells you about everyone. To be polite, one would refer to Stuart Poynton as a syndicated political columnist. No one was ever polite about Stuart Poynton. His columns demonstrated very little interest in politics, just politicians and other power people. His typical column had 4 to 6 hot, tawdry, indicative items. Years ago, Senator so-and-so and his family had vacationed at a hunting lodge owned by a corporation his subcommittee is now regulating. Judge so-and-so was seen leaving a party in Georgetown at 3 a.m. Congressman so-and-so fudged his fact-finding junket to Iran so he could visit his son in Zurich. Some of which were accurate enough to attract suits. Always going for the jugular in his desire to reform others, over the years he had accomplished little, except to harden everyone's jugular. You know who I am? Yes, Poynton, Stuart Poynton. Oh, Fletch responded to this forced humility. Nice to meet you. Well, I was thinking this. Stuart Poynton was staring at his hands clasped between his knees in thinking this. A little hard for me to operate around here. Too much meeting and greeting going on. Well, point is, everyone here knows who I am, and everyone is sort of, you know, watching me. He looked sideways at Fletch. Got me? Gotcha. Makes it hard for me to operate, you know. Carry on my own investigation, find out anything. And this Walter March thing is a hell of a story. You mean Walter March? I said Walter March. The point is, I can ask questions and so forth, but these idiotic conventioneers, well, you know, they seem to get a great kick out of giving Stuart Point a bum steer. Some of them have tried already. Geez, you can't believe some of the crazy things they've told me around here, and with a straight face. Fletch said, gotcha. I can't blame them, of course. It's a convention, after all. Fun and games are part of it. Fletch had raised his chair back a few notches. Point is, I am Stuart Poynton. Again, the sideways look. Got me? You got it right. And I am here. Gotcha. And the whole world knows that I'm here. Right. And here at Kendrick's Plantation, there's an important story. Hendrick's Plantation. What? Hendrick's, H as in waffle. I feel I ought to come up with something on the Walsh March murder. Walter. You know, as a decent, self-respecting journalist. Some insight, something indicative. You know, some little item or items that will mean something, prove to be right through the apprehension, trial, and conviction of the murderer. Well, I don't see how you can do that without solving the crime. Well, that would help. Solving the Walter March murder would make a good item for your column, Fletch said mildly. Might be worth a graph or two. Point is, Poynton said, everyone knows I'm here. Everyone knows there's a big story here, but I'm so well known here, if you get me, my hands are tied. Gotcha. Jack Williams tells me you're a hell of an investigative reporter. You mean Jake Williams? Oh, that's what I said. And good old Howard. Yeah, well, I asked him last night who he thought could help me out. You know, shag a few facts for me. You're unemployed? Presently unencumbered by earned income. You have no outlet? Only the kind you can flush. I mean, if you had a story, it would probably be difficult for you to get it published. There's no front page being held for me. I thought not. Maybe we can work something out. What I'm thinking is this. Poynton again went into his staring at hands clasped between his knees propositional pose. You be my eyes and ears. You know, do legwork. Circulate. Talk to them. Listen to them. If you do any keyhole stuff, I don't want to know about it. Just the facts. All I want. See what you can dig up. Report to me. Fletch let the next question hang silent in the air. Poynton sat back in his chair. Depending on what you come up with, of course. When I get back to New York, well, maybe I could use another leg man. Maybe. The three I have are pretty well known, which is why I can't bring them in here. Everyone in the business knows who they are. In fact, they've about served their purpose. Hell of an offer, Fletch said. Poynton glanced at him nervously. Leg man for Walter Poynton. Wow. Stuart, said Stuart Poynton. Fletch looked at him, puzzled. Of course, I'd pick up your expenses here at the convention, too, Poynton said. Of course, you'll be working for me. Poynton turned full face to Fletch. What do you say? Will you do it? You bet. You will? Sure. A shake on it. Poynton held out his hand, and they shook. Now, he said, reclasping his hands, what have you got so far? Not much, Fletch said. I haven't really been working. Come on, Poynton said. Reporter's instincts. Just arrived yesterday. Must have heard a few things.
Well, of course.
Like what?
Well, I heard something funny about the desk clerk.
The desk clerk here at the hotel?
Yeah, seems Walter March got very angry when he arrived. Desk clerk made some fresh crack at Mrs. March. March took his name and said he was going to report him to the manager in the morning. Someone said the clerk's pretty heavily in debt, you know, the horses.
Well, that would tie in with the scissors, Poynton said.
What scissors?
The scissors, Poynton said. The scissors found in Walter March's back. They came from the reception desk in the lobby.
Wow, said Fletch.
Also the timing of the murder.
What do you mean?
The clerk would have to nail March before he left his room in the morning, before the hotel manager arrived at work, before March had a chance to report the clerk to the manager.
Hey, Fletch said, that's right.
Another thing, Poynton said, there's been the question of how anyone got into the suite to murder March in the first place.
Fletch said, I don't get you.
The desk clerk, Poynton said. He'd have the key.
Wow, Fletch said, right.
Again, the nervous glance from Poynton. Sounds worth investigating, he said. See what you can dig up.
Yes, sir.
Three youngsters were throwing something into the pool and then diving after it.
I heard something else, Poynton said.
Oh, what?
Ronnie Wisham, Fletch said.
You mean Raleigh Wisham?
That's what I said.
Must be the noise from the pool.
Seems Walsh March had started an editorial campaign to get this Wisham character fired from the network and ordered March newspapers coast to coast to follow up.
Really? Why would he do that?
Apparently this Wisham is one of these bleeding-heart reporters, an advocate journalist.
Yeah.
Raleigh Wisham did features for one of the networks, and they were usually on society's downside. Prisoners, mental patients, migrant workers, welfare mothers. He always ended his reports saying, "This is Raleigh Wisham with love."
Son of a bitch, said Fletch.
March thought he was unprofessional. As president of the AJA, he wanted Ronnie Wisham drummed out of journalism.
Well, that'd be a motive for murder, all right, Fletch said.
Walter March could have succeeded in a campaign like that to get rid of someone.
Jack Williams confirmed last night that these articles are going to run. Then there'd be an incessant campaign against this Ronnie Wisham character.
And these articles are not going to run now?
No. Jack Williams feels beating up on somebody like Ronnie Wisham would result in a sort of bad image for Walsh March.
I see, said Fletch. Very clear.
Freddie Arbuthnot appeared around the hedge. She was wearing tennis whites and carrying a racket.
William said he was sure the other managing editors in the chain would feel the same way.
Sure, said Fletch.
Poynton saw Freddie approaching them and stood up.
See what you can dig up, he said.
Thanks, Mr. Poynton.
Fletch got out of the long chair and introduced Frederick Arbuthnot and Stuart Poynton by saying, Miss Blake, I'd like you to meet Mr. Gessner.
As they shook hands, Poynton gave Fletch a glance of gratitude, and Freddie gave him her usual, you're weird look.
After Poynton ambled away, Freddie said,
You get along well with everybody.
Sure, Fletch said, I'm very amiable.
That was Stuart Poynton, she said.
Are you sure?
Why did you introduce him as whatever?
Are you Miss Blake?
I am not Miss Blake.
Are you Freddie Arbuthnot?
I am Freddie Arbuthnot.
Are you sure?
I've looked it up.
You have nice knees. Very clean.
Hoo boy.
She blushed slightly beneath her tan.
You've been listening through my bathroom wall. Whatever do you mean? That was a little song I was taught as a child.
She was blushing more.
The Wash Me Up song.
Oh, Fletch said.
There's a difference between boys and girls. I was taught the Wash Me Down song.
She put her fist between his ribs and pushed.
There's a difference between people and horses, she said. People and weirdos.
Playing tennis? He asked.
Thought I might.
You have a partner, of course.
Actually, I don't.
Odd, said Fletch.
There seems to be a court reserved in my name, 11 o'clock.
And no partner?
None I know of.
That is odd, she said. One ought to have a partner to play tennis.
Indeed.
Makes the game nicer.
I suspect so.
Would you please go get dressed?
Why are people always saying that to me?
I suspect people aren't always saying that to you.
Oh, well, said Fletch.
Miss Blake is waiting for you, Freddie Arbuthnot said softly, patiently.
Chapter 15. 12 o'clock. Cocktails. Bobby Joe Hendricks Lounge. From tape. Station 17, room 102. Crystal Fioni.
Hi, Bob. Is this Robert McConnell?
This is Crystal Fioni.
Crystal Fioni, we sat at the same table last night. I was the big one in the flower print tent.
Yeah, isn't she gorgeous? That's Frederick Arbuthnot. I'm the other one, the one twice the size people spend half the time looking at.
Say, I really dig you, Bob. I think you're great. I read your stuff all the time.
Yeah, I read your piece this morning on the murder of Walter March. You mentioned Fletcher. Fletcher?
We used to work together. On a newspaper in Chicago.
You really put it to him, didn't you? What was it you wrote? Something about Fletcher's already having figured prominently in two murder cases but never indicted, and he used to work for Walter March? Let me tell you something about Fletch.
Useful information? Why, sure, honey.
Oh, just a funny little story, really.
See, there was this guy in Chicago Fletch didn't like much, a real badass named Upsy, a pimp running a whole string of girls in Chicago, real young kids, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, picking them up at the bus station the minute they hit town, pilling them up, then shooting them up, putting them straight on the street, sometimes the same damn night they hit town. As soon as the kids got to the point where they couldn't stand up anymore, couldn't even attract fleas, which was usually a few months at most, like as not they'd be found overdosed in some alley or run over by a car, you know? A big, nasty business Upsy was running. This fast turnover in girls meant there was very little live evidence against him, ever. What's more, he could pay off heavy in all directions, up and down the fuzz ladder. This was a very slippery badass. Fletch wanted the story. He wanted the details. He wanted the hard evidence. Of course, he got no cooperation from the police. And the newspaper wasn't cooperating either. The editors, they said, you know, what's one pimp? It isn't worth the space to run the story. Typical. And Fletch wasn't doing this precisely right, either. Every time he talked a girl into his confidence and began getting stuff he could use as evidence, he'd realize what he was doing, what he was asking them to do in turning state's evidence, allow themselves to be dragged through the newspapers and television and courts for months, if not years. Upsy had already badly damaged their lives in one way. Fletch saw himself badly damaging their lives in another way. These kids were so young, Bob. Anyway, as soon as Fletch got the story from each girl, instead of using it, he found himself getting her to a social service agency, a hospital, or getting up the scratch to bus her home, whatever he thought would work. He did this 6-8 times, maybe. Well, Upsy got upset. He was pretty sure, I guess, Fletch wasn't going to be able to print anything on him, ever. What with no police support, no newspaper support, and while Fletch kept sending his best sources of evidence home on a bus... But nevertheless, Fletch was hurting Upsy's business by continually taking these girls away from Upsy before they were ready to be wiped. Get the point? So Upsy sends a couple of goons out, and they find Fletch, drag him out of his car. A real honey, a dark green Fiat convertible, I loved it. And while they hold him at a distance, arms behind his back, they put a fuse in the gas tank and light it, and the car blows all over the block. The goons say, "Upsy's upset. Next time, the fuse goes up your ass, and it won't be just gas at the other end." So, next night, it was a Saturday night, Fletch finds Upsy getting out of his pimpmobile and goes up to him as smooth as cream cheese, hand out to shake, and says, "Upsy, I apologize. Let me buy your drink." Just like that. Upsy's wary at first, but figures, hell, Fletch is aced. He's aced other people easily enough. Maybe it might be nice to have someone on the newspaper he has in his pocket, whatever. Fletch takes him into the nearest dive, buys Upsy a drink, tries to explain he was just doing his job, but what the hell, what did the newspaper care? He could end up dead on the sidewalk for all the newspaper cared. He'd brought a little pill with him, something one of Upsy's own girls had given him, and when Upsy was nice and relaxed and beginning to tell Fletch about his having been a 9-year-old newspaper boy on the South Side, Fletch slips the pill into Upsy's chin. In a very few minutes, Upsy's swaying, doesn't know what the hell he's doing, begins to pass out. And Fletch, still as smooth as canned applesauce, walks him out and puts Upsy in the passenger seat of the pimpmobile at the curb, see? He drives Upsy to this heavy, ornate Episcopal church Fletch knows about, knows how to get into that hour of Saturday night, and helps him into the church and sits him on the floor where Upsy passes out. On the floor, Fletch strips Upsy of all his pimp finery. Then he places him spread-eagled on his back in the center aisle, bare-ass, bad-ass naked, and ties his wrists and ankles to the last few pews. Did I say spread-eagled? In the dark. Then he takes a thin wire and ties it up around Upsy's balls, around his penis, you know, and runs that straight and fairly taut to the huge brass doorknob of the heavy front door of the church. There's a purple velvet drape around the door, and the door is solid oak. He ties the wire nice and tight to the doorknob. Then Fletch goes up to the altar and drags the bishop's chair over so he can sit in it and see Upsy way down the center aisle, but Upsy can't see him. By and by, Upsy wakes up and groans, obviously not feeling too well, and tries to roll over and finds he's tied to something, all four points, and wakes up more, and tugs at the ropes, and then raises his head to look down at himself and finds he's tied at his fifth point, too. He can't see too well in the dark, probably well enough to see that he's in a church. and he remains reasonably relaxed, still groggy from the liquor and the drug, probably curious about what's happening to him, tied spread-eagled and naked, lying on a church floor. It's dawn, and light comes into the church, all red and blue and yellow in streaks through the big stained glass windows, and the wire begins to pick up the light and gleam. And Upsy has his head up all the time now, as much as his neck muscles can stand it, trying to see where the wire leads. In a while, there's enough light in the church to start getting into the draped, recessed doorway, and shortly the big brass doorknob begins to gleam. Even Fletch can see it from the altar, and it's clear even from where he's sitting that the wire leads straight from Upsy's balls to the doorknob of these doors, which must weigh a ton. Upsy sees it too, of course, and begins to figure it out. Begins tugging at his ropes, flexing one arm and then the other, pulling each leg up against the ropes. He realizes there's no way he's going to get free unless someone helps him. But he doesn't get the real point of what's happening to him, or what's going to happen to him, until the church bells begin to ring, all over Chicago. It's then he begins shouting, "Oh no! Oh God! Oh no!" He remembers it's Sunday morning, and at some point, sooner or later, those heavy oak doors are going to be swung wide open by hundreds of joyous Christians en masse, you might say, strong in their faith. It's then that Upsy's body fluids begin leaving him. In sheer terror, he pisses almost at the church door like a skunk shooting at something he knows is going to destroy him. He's lying in his own shit, just tons of it pouring out of him. He's sweating buckets and shaking and pulling at his ropes. He knows that when those heavy oak doors are swung open, he's had it. Did I say he was yelling? He's yelling and screaming. First the words, help me, someone, in this cavernous church with solid stone walls, and then he's yelling every obscenity in the book in furious anger, tugging at the rope so hard his wrists and ankles burn through, bleeding, and then he begins to blubber. I don't deserve this, and crying. He thinks about this a while, and then begins twisting his head toward the altar, yelling, oh God, I'm sorry. Fletch picked the right church. This particular church didn't have Sunday service until 11 in the morning. But a lot of other churches in town had services before then. And every time one of the other church's bells begins to ring, Upsy pulls harder on his ropes, the ropes tying him. He wears the ropes right down to his wrist and ankle bones. He even begins biting his left arm, through the muscle, thinking he would chew his arm off, I guess, until he realizes that that would do no good. If he chewed off one arm, he still wouldn't be able to untie the rest of himself. See? More and more church bells ring around town, calling their congregations to service, and Upsy is screaming more and more incomprehensively, very hoarse by now, convulsively tugging at his ropes, ever one more time, hoping something would give way, blood and shit all over himself, eyes bulging from his head. At 10:30, after hours of this, the church bells of that church begin to go off, and Upsy becomes even more frantic. He knows it's only a few minutes now at most before that heavy oak door is swung open. He's thrashing around the floor as much as the ropes will let him, twisting and splashing in his own blood and shit. Even Fletch couldn't hear him yelling over the sound of the church bells. He could just see his mouth open, jaws straining, tongue extended. Upsy's eyes are rolling in his head in terror. Then the big brass doorknob begins to turn. Slowly, slowly.